from the heart of the Forest City, this is a Craig Needles podcast brought to you by Lexus of London. Now here's your host, Craig Needles.
Brand new episode, Craig Needles podcast here on a Tuesday. Thank you very much for downloading and listening. We hope you continue to do that at classicrock981.com, londonnewstoday.ca, and of course on your favorite podcast app. And I want to talk about our healthcare system today because our healthcare system, it's not in great shape. And there are some weaknesses here. I want to discuss what those are. And I want to figure out why we really didn't talk about them a whole lot during the provincial election that we just had just over a month ago. So who better to join me to discuss that than Peter Berg-Mandis, who, of course, with the Ontario Health Coalition, joins us here on the Craig Needles podcast to have that conversation. Peter, thank you so much for doing this today. We appreciate it.
It is my honor to be here and to greet you and your listeners.
So, Peter, let's first talk about the weaknesses within the system. And they're here and they are very much real. We are hearing about shortages in staffing at London Health Sciences Center. I was talking to a doctor off the record about this yesterday, saying, hey, it's kind of a difficult place to be right now, finding enough people to fill the shifts. We're talking about, you know, we hear things of bed shortages. We have plenty of beds. We just don't have staff to work at those beds. So where are the weaknesses in the system right now in your mind, and how are they impacting people who are going to seek care?
Well, it's clearly, the conditions of care are the conditions of work. And for decades now, we knew that something like this could take place. It isn't like overnight the pandemic completely disrupted everything in the healthcare system. It was a gradual decline over decades of under-resourcing. Staffing was being systematically reduced. You may or may not know that, we had a restructuring of the entire system in London over 20 years ago. And through that, we closed two emergency departments. We closed 2,000 beds and the trained staff that went with them. We literally lost 80% of our psychiatric inpatient beds. Through the closure of London Psychiatric and through St. Thomas Psych. And so you suddenly are hit with a massive global pandemic and there's no leeway left. We just cut ourselves into a corner. And it's little surprise now that people are burning out. The current situation is such that no one can get time off when they need time off to be with their family and loved ones. And it's not being made any more attractive by a pandemic, nor the fact that wages are being held at a 1% increase, even though we're in an environment of inflation that's over 7%. So healthcare workers, they're going to vote with their feet. They're going to, you know, fight like hell to help us. But if the government ties their hands, what are they going to do?
Yeah, that's I get it. And, you know, the problems here start at the government level. I do think there is an accountability issue when it comes to hospitals and some of this stuff. And I've been talking about this on the radio and on podcast form and on the internet for years. But I think there is an accountability issue when it comes to hospital boards and the way hospitals are governed. But it absolutely does start with Queen's Park and the people who are running the province of Ontario, and that the dollars just aren't there in order to make this a more effective system.
Yeah, and it's been that way since the 90s, right? So this is not news. It's been a phenomenon that we were well aware of and raising an alarm about for many years.
COVID turned the warning meter up a little bit, though, because we saw really how perilous the system was over this last 2 years that we've been in here.
And you're right there, Craig. I think the average citizen, unless they were sick and, you know, ran afoul of the system, they pretty well enjoyed a pretty decent level of health care. But COVID kind of provided a wide open view of what is going on. There's not enough people here to look after someone. We have hallway medicine that predates COVID, and yet now it's even worse. And, you know, where do we admit people that are seriously ill when there's no staff? Yeah, you've nailed that.
Yeah, that's we've sort of seen that undercut, especially when a whole lot of hospital staff were getting COVID. So the limited staff that were there already may not have been able to come to work for whatever reasons. And there's just it's been a time where a lot of the flaws have become very bright and very easy to see.
For sure. And it's I've never in my experience, and I started actually working in an emergency department in the 1980s. Wherein it was, you know, unacceptable to see someone waiting for 2 hours in a emergency department. I, in my own living experience, have just, I'm completely speechless at the thought that we're looking at people over 17 hours waiting just to be seen and assessed in an emergency department now. That's just beyond belief.
Yeah, it's unacceptable. It's simply unacceptable. And there's got to be ways for it to be better. And look, I think some of that starts with maybe the compensation is a little too heavy at the very top and not good enough for nurses. And we can talk about Bill 21 and things along those lines. That's part of it. But just it comes down to, if we want a better system, we need a system that's better funded, where the hospitals aren't falling apart. And look, I hear about inefficiencies, and I've got people that work in the hospital in all the different departments come to me all the time and say, hey, if the people who ran this place a little bit better knew what they were doing, it wouldn't be perfect, but we would be better off and be able to do more for about the same number of dollars that we're getting. I get that's a complicated thing to look at, but we've got to be looking under all the rocks and looking at all the nooks and crannies here, because the system just simply isn't good enough. We've got to make it better, right?
Well, we always have been told the story of trying to, you know, reduce redundancy and duplication. But of course, that's also the backstop that we've had to save us when something like a surge like what we're experiencing now takes place. And yet, even that said, it's like the redundancies were always made at the expense of frontline care, not at the very top of the heap. And, you know, some hospitals clearly do better than others. Here in London, I would suggest that St. Joe's Healthcare did a great job of flatlining the bureaucracy. But LHSC, I mean, it's a massive conglomerate. And here in, day out, like, there's frontline staff not able to take a break, and yet they're being told to be resilient by managers. It isn't a problem of resiliency. These people have been giving their all, and quite frankly, it's shameful to tell someone who's done everything from the safety of one's office that they got to be more resilient.
Yeah, resilient is not the word, or lack of resilience, I should say, are not words that I would use to describe most doctors and nurses that I've met, certainly over the last 2 years. I got to ask you, because we talked about the government aspect of this. And I've wondered about this on the roundtable online when I've talked about it on Classic Rock 98.1. Why did we just have an Ontario election where it felt like the things that you and I are talking about right now, which, as you said, have been going on since the 90s in some cases, were barely even discussed? And if you want to look at us in the media for some of that, I think that's fair. Not me, because I was talking about this stuff, but other people, you know, people besides me. I think about the opposition, though. Why didn't we hear about this from Andrea Horvath? Why didn't we hear about this from Stephen Del Duca? And I know that they must have done some polling and thought that, hey, talking about COVID-19 is bad and people don't want to hear it, which, fair enough. But I think talking about the fact that our healthcare system got in a lot of trouble in the midst of COVID-19 because it was underfunded, and hey, maybe that's why we had to do more days without school and more quote-unquote lockdown days than other places in the country did, I think that should have been fair game during the election. Peter, were you disappointed by what we saw sort of in the lead up to June 2nd?
Yeah, it would be an understatement to say I was disappointed. I was completely flabbergasted. Now, we know, you know, the Ontario voter abstained en masse. And, you know, that's obviously a sore point for all of us who believe in a democratically elected government. So that aside, it is also quite true that the two contending parties for government, apart from the Progressive Conservatives, chose to snipe at each other more than they actually went after the sitting government for its misdeeds. And as well, I've gone through a few of these rounds of campaign style politics, and literally this is the first one where I ever saw that not only did the conservatives not go out to any kind of public mass demonstration of, you know, what their policies are, they were frequently framing it specifically just for media, and even telling media, yourself excluded, of course, Craig, that you can't ask any questions. We're just going to give you this little prepared speech. And frankly, I think
that that I will say I was included in that, because I asked for interviews with the premier and things along those lines during the campaign. I was essentially told, no, this wasn't going to happen. So I wanted to ask questions. I just was never given the opportunity. And that was their strategy, to be clear. And the cynic in me says, hey, you know what? They're just trying to win an election. But the fact that the conditions in this province were as such that you could win an election by avoiding any scrutiny of your plan, that's not a good sign for the province.
No kidding. You probably heard this before. Like, you wouldn't go into a job interview and refuse to answer your employer's questions and expect to get the job. And yet in our province, you know, all the flaws that there may well have been, our media was treated like nothing but scribes, and no questioning, critical analysis was permitted. So it is kind of a disturbing sign of the times, I guess, is that that actually worked now? I don't think when I was a young guy, this would have worked. Someone doesn't want to talk about their record. It means they got things to hide.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something to that. To me, it just comes back to the opposition didn't do a good enough job expressing to Ontarians, here's why you should vote for us. So people just defaulted, oh, we'll just go with the people who are running the province now. So like, where was, you know, Andrea Horvath or Stephen Del Duca or whoever saying, hey, our healthcare system, not good enough right now. Vote for us. We're going to put this into it. I know that there was stuff like that in the platforms, but it felt like I heard way more about Buckeride Transit than I ever did about what was going to go on with the healthcare system. And healthcare probably should, well, not probably, certainly should have been the number one issue of the campaign when you look at the last 2 years we've just been through. You don't even have to mention COVID-19 to still say, hey, our healthcare system needs some assistance here.
Yeah, you're so right, Craig. It's just, it boggles the mind that the number one issue was barely mentioned by the two opposition parties. And they had ample, well, I mean, should restrict what I'm saying, not ample opportunity, but
some opportunity.
Some opportunity. And it was directed at each other instead of actually challenging the Ford government on its record that, you know, why is it that there is no ring of iron around long-term care? And why are you giving all these beds to some of the worst profit-driven providers that cause the greatest amount of harm? And yet that wasn't driven home to the public's mind. So it is very frustrating. We're a nonpartisan group, so I'm not suggesting that we wouldn't have attacked or criticized either of the other two parties if they had been successful. But, you know, the sitting government is the one in charge during the worst world health calamity we've ever experienced, and it literally had no opposition.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right about that. And I will say, you know, people say, well, you know, Peter is just in the bag with the liberals. He hates the conservatives. People should listen to what you were saying when Dalton McGuinty and Kathleen Wynne were in charge, because it sounded not dissimilar to the stuff you're telling me right now about the way the government has handled this situation. So there's that. I was disappointed by the lack of significant conversation about the future of this province during the campaign, because, as you said, it degenerated into Andrea Horvath and Stephen Del Duca both wanted to be official opposition because they figured that might be job savers for them. Turned out it was not a job saver for Horvath, and Del Duca didn't even win his own seat, so that was going to be the end of the road for him. It just was a really, really lousy showing from the Liberals and the NDP in this campaign. And from a political perspective, just pure politics, you know, good for Doug Ford and company. They took advantage of a situation they were given, but I just kind of felt they were handed this election on a silver platter. They didn't even really have to work for it.
Yeah, that's what's so maddening about it, isn't it? It's we couldn't get them to come to an all candidates meeting. We couldn't get them to
because they were up by 10 points the entire time. So why would they do anything else? So I get that it's a chicken or the egg thing here, but that's kind of why they were in that position where they could avoid all that stuff is because they knew we're going to win no matter what. Why even show up?
Yeah, and we even caught them, you know, with their pants down around the privatization of public health services. You know, Christine Elliott at the time is like in February announcing that they're going to provide funding for independent health facilities to run private hospitals. Boom, she says it right there, video. And then they backpedal and deny that they ever said it. Like, how is this working in a functional democracy? We don't seem to have one.
No. And you mentioned, 57% of eligible voters in this province decided, you know what? I'm going to sit this one out. And there's a reason that happened, too. And we've got to sort of come to grips with that.
You're so right. That is a real wake up call that, you know, 57%, the majority of eligible voters don't exercise their franchise. You don't have a democracy that is functioning. And accountability is what democracy is about. That means we don't have accountability. And so getting back to your point about healthcare, universal public healthcare is about accountability to the public. And right now, we don't have anything that resembles that.
So getting back to the healthcare conversation before we wrap up here, Peter, what do you want to see? And look, maybe you don't think you're going to see it over the next 4 years, but what should be the immediate actions? If out of some miracle, Doug Ford called you and said, Peter, what should I be doing here? If Sylvia Jones called you and said, Peter, what should I be doing here? What would you tell them?
Well, I'd certainly say, wow, that's a first. But
I didn't know that you had my number.
Yeah, you had my number a long time, but first time you called. Okay. It would certainly be, and I'll put it right in the context of what we're hearing today. So we know we don't have enough staff. We know we can't retain them. We can't recruit them because of the situation we're in. So immediately first is we have to have serious bed studies, which is something that hasn't been done in 35 years for per community that requires understanding what the needs of that community are when it comes to their public health services. I will tell you this time and time again, we cut too far and a generation ago had more public service access than we have now today. That's irregardless of a pandemic. So we would have to have a real scientific empirical understanding of what is our community needs. And London has grown double since I've been around on this planet. And we have less services than when I was a baby. So we need to establish that as a baseline to know what staffing would be required for the services that those beds would entail. And I'm telling you, it's going to be expensive. It's going to be a long project because it took us 40 years to get here. It's going to take another 40 to get us out of this hole. So today it would be instantly get the resources into funding for education, for more trained PSWs, nurses, physicians, and automatically open up that conditions of employment where you'd have to make sure that they're going to stay in the job. And it's going to be a long haul. Immediately today, we would probably need to flood the resources of specific hospitals just so that at least we know we have backstop measures. So in London, you'd have to designate, say, LHSC for the most serious things as, you know, we should, but maybe rebuild St. Joseph's as well. Have it there as the COVID backstop facility and the one that does all the day surgeries, releasing LHSC to do the serious trauma and cardiac care issues. You know, there's so many things that we should be doing like within the next few months and not years. And we could do it. It is just release the resources that even means more funding. I know the premiers are getting together and they're harping on the federal government to do more and as they should, but there should be strings attached. Absolutely. They should be attached to public healthcare outcomes, not to be fittered away to private institutions that are going to take profit off the top. And, you know, we could do it. We have ORs right now, my friend, that are sitting idle in the public hospitals right here in London because they can't staff them. And they couldn't staff them before the pandemic because they couldn't afford to pay to keep them open round the clock. And we need to keep those things going round the clock now if we're ever going to get back on a square footing that is going to reduce our wait times. So we've got a long road ahead of us, and I'm just touching on a few things here.
Yeah, there's a lot to think about. I want to ask you about one quick thing before we go. I've been hearing during the conservative federal leadership race, hey, we've got to do a better job of recognizing foreign credentials in Canada when it comes to not just medical staff, but other credentials that some might earn. Do you think that that's something that could or should make a difference in our situation here in the province of Ontario if we started doing a better job of recognizing foreign medical credentials for doctors, nurses, whatever it is?
I think we probably should absolutely be looking at it as part of the multi-pronged approach. Certainly understand that the Ford government has promised to open up more medical school training positions. We got to be talking in the thousands, though, not like 100 or so here and there. And that would require the mobilization of like Quebec did, 10,000 PSWs alone with, you know, a decent pay increase just to get them to work in the field. So, I mean, this is colossal resources that would have to be thrown at this. New immigrants, many are highly qualified. I've certainly worked with physicians that come from around the world. And some are now no longer as a physician working in a position that's like a PSW because they'd have to take their training all over again here, which is ludicrous. So there's things for the College of Physicians and doctors to actually look at here too. You know, what is really legitimate here as to requirements for their field of work versus, you know, just the fact that we've been for decades trying to protect our internal positions. So you got a lot there, Craig. I wish we had 2 days of this to talk about.
Yeah.
It's a complex system that is vibrant and robust, but it is being cored out. And we do have to face the tune that we have to pay for it. And that means higher taxes for especially the super rich. So be it.
Peter, I wish we could talk more, but time constraints here going against us. But this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for having it with me. I definitely appreciate it.
I appreciate talking to you again after so many years. Glad you're healthy, and I hope you stay well.
That's Peter Bergmanis, who, of course, with the Ontario Health Coalition, joining us here on the Craig Needles podcast, which is brought to you by our friends over at Lexus of London. Lifestyle with the drive. Your new Lexus is patiently waiting at Lexus of London. Luxury redefined. Choose yours today at the award-winning Lexus of London, 1065 Warncliffe Road South, and online at lexusoflondon.com. I want to talk about one more thing before we wrap up. And this is something that happened last week, but I wanted to play you the exchange because I tweeted about it a little bit and people asked to hear it. So here it is. Anita Anand, defense minister, joined Peter Fragascatos at General Dynamics. They wanted to have a conversation about sending 39 light armor vehicles to Ukraine, which is fine. Ukraine needs the assistance. They're having a tough time right now. But when I was there, I heard about all these light armor vehicles and how they're going to be so efficient when it came to, you know, helping folks with Ukraine. I couldn't help but wonder, hey, wait a minute. Aren't these very same light armor vehicles in Saudi Arabia right now helping the Saudi government do some things that I think most of us would consider to be not very good? Which I don't think is an unreasonable thing to suggest. You look at the Jamal Khashoggi situation. Let's not forget what's going on between or has been going on between Saudi Arabia and Yemen. Hey, maybe the fact that they also have these very same light armor vehicles that you're telling us are just so awesome, maybe that's a bit of a red flag. So I wanted to ask about that. I think it's a fair question. And the reaction was, as you may be able to guess, not super positive. Here is the exchange at that Q&A portion of the media conference that Anita Anand was having.
Minister, you just spoke about the effectiveness of these vehicles in helping both in Ukraine and Canadian Armed Forces personnel. I want to talk about the effectiveness of these vehicles in helping the Saudi Arabian government, which these vehicles have been sold there as well. Do you have concerns that those vehicles are being used for things that Canada would not approve of in human rights concerns in Yemen, knowing, as you said, these vehicles are very effective?
Well, I'm glad you touched on the efficacy of the vehicles. Obviously, this is why we're here today. This is why Canada is purchasing up to 39 vehicles for use on the Ukrainian front lines. It's exactly the point that needs to be made. The efficacy and the utilization of these labs could not be understated in the importance of them. Now, in terms of your question, I will say that Global Affairs has conducted a review and as a result announced in 2020 that permits are now being reviewed on a case-by-case basis. And these permits are not issued automatically. Each permit is carefully scrutinized, and the Minister of Foreign Affairs herself will deny any permit application, basically where there is any substantial risk of a human rights violation. At the same time, it is important to ensure Canada's commercial credibility in contracting, and those are the two principles that we are balancing in developing the policy approach in this area. But as I said, permits are reviewed on a case-by-case basis, and the Minister of Foreign Affairs will deny any permit application where there's a substantial risk of a human rights violation. Thank you.
So I'm to take from that the Minister does not believe there's a substantial risk of human rights violations being committed by the Saudi Arabian government?
You can take from that I am outlining the process.
No, that's the process, but does the minister not believe that?
By which the minister undertakes her review, and we have to trust our public servants on these issues in terms of the policy direction that they are taking. As I said, human rights are an incredibly important aspect of Canadian government's foreign policy, and we will continue to uphold our commitment to human rights around the world. Thank you.
Okay. So it was just one question, one follow-up.
I can get one more, though. There's no one else waiting for me.
We'll have time for one more question.
My follow-up would be, just on the subject of the process, you said the minister would deny any permits for situations where human rights violations may be a problem. So I'm taking from that the minister does not believe there may be human rights violations issues with Saudi Arabia. I have a hard time with that explanation. My question is, are there human rights violations going on in Saudi Arabia, and are you concerned these vehicles might be part of them?
Well, I'm going to back up, and I'm going to say that our country has one of the world's strongest export control systems in the world, and we are committed to respecting the highest standards in the review of export permits sought by Canadian companies. As you can appreciate, that is not a process that occurs under the Department of National Defense, the department of which I am the minister under. Therefore, I will leave my comments as they stand. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, there's that. Do with it what you will. Listen, I felt as though there was a lack of preparation for that question, almost like they didn't see it coming. They thought it was going to be a rah, 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 we love Ukraine type of media Q&A. They clearly should have expected, hey, wait, someone might have something to say about Saudi Arabia and the fact that they get these very same vehicles. You would think that would have been on the radar. And I'm not saying it wasn't for sure, but it felt to me like it wasn't. That's our podcast for today. Coming up on Friday, we have more of the roundtable. We're going to be getting into some stuff going on with TENS Values at School Board, look at some other issues in the community as well. Hopefully you can tune in for that. Download that podcast coming up on Friday. Between now and then, of course, more stuff at classicrock981.com, londonnewstoday.ca if you want to go back and listen. Plus, of course, the Twitter feed at Needles on News. We will be back at you, like I said, Friday. And this podcast, of course, is brought to you by the people over at Lexus of London. Lifestyle with the drive. You knew Lexus is patiently waiting at Lexus of London. Luxury redefined. Choose yours today at the award-winning Lexus of London, 1065 Warrencliffe Road South, and online at lexusoflondon.com.
The Craig Needles Podcast is a presentation of the Blackburn Media Podcast Network.